podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
I'm Sam Keir, host of Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. For the past 12 months, I've been talking to T20 star David Visa, getting his take from behind the scenes at the IPL, the 100 and the rest of the world's biggest leagues.
That's the Donnelly view system, Diogo. There's no ways in my mind that was up.
These guys don't know how to win at this stage.
He had his driver pick him up in his Bentley.
People start chanting your name. You kind of have to pinch yourself.
Hitman for Hire, a year in the life of a franchise cricketer. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Sport Social.
This is the Armchair Cricket Podcast.
Hello all. Welcome to another episode of Armchair Cricket Podcast, a podcast focusing on test cricket by armchair critics of the game. I'm your host, Arjit. In today's episode, we have a much sought-after guest. I must say, at least for me, I've meaning to have him on the podcast for a while already. So he's a very famous author who's been the author of multiple books on cricket. So welcome to the podcast, Anindya Datta.
Hi. Thank you, Arjit. Very kind of you. Delighted to be here.
This is a podcast about like amateur cricket followers, but you are a professional. So
absolutely not.
All right.
I'm an amateur in the guise of a writer.
Well, that's all right. So let's start there with what brought you to cricket and what led you to actually put your thoughts on paper in as much as publishing them. So if you can summarize your journey on where you started and how you started following cricket.
Well, how I started following cricket is going to watch my first test match with my dad when I was 7 years old. India versus West Indies in Calcutta at the Eden Gardens, 1974-75. And fell in love with the game. Fast forward several years, I guess about 12 years ago, one day, I saw an article written by a friend on an Australian website, and I didn't particularly agree with the views expressed there, so I decided to write something on my own, just in case somebody ever printed it. I'd never published anything in my life. I wrote something, sent it across. Much to my surprise, it got published. There was a lot of peer reviews of the article, if you like, which were quite flattering. And then I wrote a couple more. One day I got a note from the editor of the website saying one of their senior writers wanted to talk to me. And so I got a call from Kirsi Meher Homji, who I had respected since the time I was a kid and I had been reading cricket books. Kirsi had read one of my articles there. And he wrote to me after that. He said, I'll write to you. And he wrote to me after that to basically say that he thought there was a book in that. And then we had a conversation where I told him that, look, Kirsi, I've written a 1,000-word article. You're telling me there's a book in it. I have no idea how to go about it because I haven't even thought about writing a book, much less, written one. And he said, look, I'm on my 15th book. I can tell you that there is a book in this. So I sort of picked his brains a little bit in terms of how to write. And that eventually became my first, well-received book called Spellbinding Spells. It remains to this day the only book ever written on single bowling spells across the history of cricket. It got very good reviews in the UK, in India, in Australia, everywhere. And that led to me wanting to actually write the book, which I'd always wanted to write, which was on the Indian spin quartet, because I'd been a spin bowler and in love with spin since I was 7 years old. And then what happened was I was commissioned to write that by one of India's largest publishers, Westland. But the editor of Westland wanted me to write a broader book. He wanted me to write a comprehensive history of Indian spin bowling rather than just on the quartet. which was a much bigger assignment than I actually realized. It took me, I think, a year and a half to work through that. Another few months to finish writing that to our mutual satisfaction. And so Wizards, the story of Indian spin bowling, came out. Mm-hmm. It won India's Cricket Book of the Year award. And so the journey started. So I've written, there are a few books that I've written purely out of passion. So I wrote a book on the Invincible Stud of 1948, which remains mm-hmm. one of my favorites. And then I was then commissioned by, and then I wrote one on the 1971 India's first two series wins in Australia, in the West Indies and England. Called The Greatest Year, mm-hmm. which unfortunately is out of print right now. And then I wrote the first history of Indian tennis called Advantage India, whose second edition just came out recently. So that's really, it's the love of the readers which has kept that alive.
Wonderful, actually. So wonderful to hear. For somebody who's a banker by day and, who works potentially different time zones, or I don't know how it works with you, but living in Singapore and working with the banking industry, how do you find the time to actually do the research that is required to publish, let's say, spin bowling? You have to go through the annals of Indian spin history, look at all the spinners from when India started and so on and so on. How do you get the time to do that?
Well, first of all, I'm not a banker anymore. So I left banking about 4 years ago, and I started my own leadership consulting firm called Two Roads, which I run out of Singapore. So that gives me a little bit more time right now to do what I want to do. Although, honestly, running your own business is much more all-consuming than working for someone. Mm-hmm. But while I was a banker, I was doing all the research and the writing at night, in the mornings, on weekends, and that's how I got through it. And you're right, that's the thing with Indian spin bowling is that there is obviously, some data out there. There are some archives out there, but sitting in Singapore, also difficult to access. But these days, with the internet, it's become much easier. With e-versions of archives available, if you really can search for it. I was also fortunate to have access to the British newspaper archives, which are a fantastic source. Right. And I'm a collector of eclectic old and rare books, which includes cricket books. So I had a lot of books which helped me on this journey. And finally, I reached out to people. I reached out to former players in England, in India, in Australia, and they were all super, super helpful. I mean, everyone from Ian Chappell to writers really, I maybe should have seen me as competition, but obviously I was a newbie, and so. But then I've realized that writers are a very, a breed who are not so selfish. They like to see others do write well as well, as long, especially cricket writers. As long as the literature keeps piling up. So I've been blessed with that, and meeting the players in the end was fantastic. Talking to them, the few hours I spent with Bishan Singh Bedi, fortunately, just before he had health issues, will forever remain in my memory.
Fantastic. I mean, maybe we should continue on another podcast episode if I am able to invite you. I want to discuss each of your books in detail, because I've only been able to, let's say, go through one of those, the story of Indian spin bowling wizards, right? The one that at least I know you very well from. But also, it was an eye-opener to see actually you've been doing it for a while, from 2017, and that you're well on your way, because you also write for a lot of online and published magazines, right? So ESPN Cricket Info, Hindustan Times.
Yeah, I write for the Cricketer magazine as well, a few articles a year. So I was writing a column for a year and a half for First Post as well. Yes,
indeed. So
currently, I write for Rev Sport in India and a few other places, Sports Star.
Fantastic. So from that perspective, does it ever come across as a pressure for you that, you know, you have to keep up with all the cricket that's coming and going if you were to want to, you know, remain relevant, but still write articles that hark back on a certain time or a certain period of cricket? Does it ever come across to you that you have to be, you have to always be up with what's going on now in the social media world, especially? Or for someone like you, looks back at a specific period, are you able to then still say, I follow the cricket I like currently, but I can completely focus on a specific, I don't know, 70s, 80s, something like this, and still get all the data you want out there. And you're not pressured to continuously be updated with the amount of cricket that is, I mean, flabbergastingly large these days.
I mean, I must confess that, yes, I have taken my path on that. So I don't follow much of the cricket that's played today if it's not of direct interest to me. So, you know, the T20 leagues, for example, which are played around the world, I have zero interest in them. I do follow the IPL, you know, because I like watching some of the players. I like watching some of the matches. But other than that, largely the T20 leagues, I really don't follow. I don't necessarily follow every test match that's being played everywhere, although there aren't that many played these days. I definitely don't follow all the ODI. But what I do like to do is, in a T20 year, I'd like to follow as much of the T20 leading up to it as possible, because, you know, that a T20 World Cup year. And in this case, since it's an ODI World Cup year, I've been closely following the, you know, the ODIs being played around the world. So I'd like to compartmentalize that, if you like. And, you know, talking about periods in history, I'm actually not I'm completely agnostic to periods in history. I've written about the 18th century cricket. I've written about 19th century cricket. I've written about extensively about 20th century cricket and 21st century cricket. So I don't look at cricket in terms of which period was it played. I look at cricket from an angle as to what's interesting about what happened at that point in time, the backstories around it. Why was it relevant for society at that point in time? What were some of the mental issues that led to matches being decided the way they were? So I have an eclectic view on cricket, if you like. So it's definitely not period specific.
Interesting. Because for me, I think that's a very unique viewpoint. Not looking at sport for the sake of sport, what happens on the field, but the bigger picture itself. Maybe what sort of pressures they faced. I mean, specifically when you're talking of Don Bradman and what sort of life he led and so on. In We Are the Invincibles and so on. So
yep.
What got you fascinated with that person, the individual? I mean, how they lived. He was a postmaster, isn't it, in a small town and so on. So how did that become?
He wasn't a postmaster. Actually, he worked as a broker. He worked as a stock market broker. But you have to be fascinated by Don Bradman if you like cricket, right? I mean, the greatest batsman who ever lived. I mean, there's nobody is going to be able to match his sheer profligacy in terms of runs. And you don't, over a long period of time as he played, have that kind of a record if you are not really good at what you do. I mean, just as an example, why Don Bradman is the greatest batsman who ever lived, his worst series, the Bodyline series, which England was very happy about, that they managed to, you know, make Bodyline work because Bradman's average fell. His average fell from 100 to 50 plus. Seriously?
Right.
It's perspective, right? So how can you not be fascinated by it? And he was a fascinating character. He wasn't the nicest man to know, but when he's a human being, right? So you have to look at his genius in terms of cricket versus how he was sometimes outside cricket, or, you know, whether he was political, how he thought about things. But he was a bloody good captain. He was a fantastic strategist, and he was a great batsman. He was not afraid to do things which, you know, like any Australian captain, which would result in the team winning, including, you know, going and during the Invincibles series, going and convincing the English not to pick their best side.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well,
you have to love a character like that. Yeah.
It was a different time. But of course, I mean, if you ask Keith Miller, probably he would have given you a different view on Don Bradman, the individual and the captain. But those are the sort of stories that make up.
I've written extensively on Miller as well. I love Miller as a character. Keith Miller as a character. He's, I think, a fantastic guy.
And I only remember that anecdote, right, where I think Don Bradman asked him to bounce an English batsman. And he said, "I will not. That guy just survived a World War II. You know, he was an aeroplane pilot and he survived that. Why will I bounce him? He shouldn't die here. That's not going to happen." So something like that. So it's very interesting. So those sort of stories stay with you, the one that you recount. And so first of all, as a fan of cricket, I must say thank you, because it's fantastic to read these sort of books, these sort of anecdotes, and the sort of stories you're able to put together. So I just say it now, but at the end of it, I think we can go through your books, or probably we can give a link to all the books that you have on Amazon. If you can share that link with me, I recommend Anindya and all of his books to the listeners of this podcast. It's been a wonderful journey for me, at least. I've read probably a bunch, but all right. Now that's about Anindya, the author. Now we go back to Anindya, the cricket fan. I think you said you've been following the Asia Cup pretty well. So I think we should start there. Were you surprised at all Bangladesh were able to, you know, beat India in that lead up to the final?
You know, I put out a tweet before the Asia Cup started, sort of asking for the potential semi-finalists. Okay. And my choice was Bangladesh as a potential semi-finalist.
Right.
Of the World Cup. Okay.
I
think if you look at the combination of the team that they have, the bowling, the batting, whether it's the pace, but the pace bowling. I mean, come on, you've got Alan Donald as a bowling coach, pace bowling coach, right? How can your fast bowlers not improve? So it's just, you know, they come through. They are coming through, I think, as a team that other teams need to watch very, very carefully. So I was too long answer to your short question. No, I was not surprised the way they played.
Well, I mean, from the rest of the tournament perspective, for me, they were not as good as they could have been. But if you think of it just as a prep for the coming World Cup, I think they're able to again line up quite a few things that they need or that they'll need to improve, and they have some time to try and put it together, because the World Cup itself is going to be a long slog, and maybe the first two or three games you can still get into it and eventually become really good. So they still have
Got Shakib. Don't forget they got Shakib as a captain, and he is a damn good captain. I mean, if you looked at the bowling changes that he made during that World Cup, you know, with the rain interruptions, etc., they were absolutely spot on. The guy's got so much experience. He's smart. He knows how to use his resources. He clearly knows the value of the very young players that he was introducing into the team. So you know, and with Tamim coming back, I think it's a team that you really need to watch.
Indeed. So then we talk about that one where Tamim, I expected, will come back. But for me, probably the lack of consistency and lack of results from the likes of Shamim Hussain and Afif Hussain, probably they're forced to bring back an old guard, a guy from the old guard, Mohammadullah. Does that surprise you?
Not so much, because, you know, going into a World Cup, if you want to get far in a World Cup, it's not just young players who are going to do it for you. It is a combination of a team which brings in quite a bit of experience. And I think from that perspective, Mohammadullah will be a good addition to the team.
Right.
Because, you know, it's a big occasion it's, you know, how he plays is another matter. If he plays well, I think he's going to be a real asset to the team. But it's worth taking that chance.
Right. I mean,
plus he's a spin bowler. He gives an element of you know, that as well as an extra spinner.
Absolutely. Now his ability to bowl well with the with the in the middle overs, let's just say, put it like that. And also potentially, you know, standing up, being a leader when the team is in trouble, be it with the bat, the ball. So he might give you a more consistent 35 of 45 rather than give you a 45 of 35, a flashy, the other way. So they've been trying to blood youngsters in the form of Shamim Hussain, Afif Hussain. And we discussed it in one of our previous podcasts as well. The Mehdis have done well. But, you know, Litton Das has been a little bit off. But we expect he'll discover his best. But once Tamim is back, I think their top order will look much more stronger. With Mahmoodullah, the lower half will get that boost. So that's why I think they've chosen them both and given them an opportunity to try to prove themselves in this New Zealand series, where I think if you look at it from just from a World Cup perspective, New Zealand are just there to acclimatize. But Bangladesh still are trying to sort out a few things in their combination. They brought in a couple of new faster bowlers, right? Tanzeed Hasan and those people. Tanzeed Hasan is the opener, but Tanzeem Hasan. Sorry, I get confused between the two. I think that's going to be interesting. So from that perspective, Bangladesh is still sort of getting there in terms of the 15 they want. So they've also not announced the 15. So from a World Cup perspective, do you see any surprises? Sudden surprises, sudden exclusions, inclusions from Bangladesh team perspective?
No, I think they're getting there, as you said. So I don't think there should be any more surprise.
All right. Then comes the final of the Asia Cup. Something happened. Siraj woke up on the right side of the bed, do you think?
I think it was a combination of Siraj putting the ball in the right places, getting the movement, and Sri Lanka having a really bad day where, you know, nothing was going right. Right. You know, you equate that to India's infamous day at Adelaide. I think the difference is that that day, if you ask Jared Kimber, statistically speaking, probably the bowling was much more outlandishly spot on. Than on this day from Siraj and Bumrah, but Siraj, you know, he just put the ball in the right places. He got it to move, and couple of balls were incredible, unplayable. Yes. But the other wickets that he got, I would suggest the Bangladeshi batsmen should blame themselves. I'm sorry, the Sri Lankan batsmen should blame themselves the way they collapsed.
Correct. I think it was the ball to Dasun Shanaka. I mean, that was, how do you play that? A leg break at 140. So not a lot you can do, pitching leg hitting off. No. You're like, okay, thanks. Exactly. Bye. And so, but for me,
they've got rid of Shanaka as captain, right?
Oh, have they? Now, this is news for me.
Right after the tournament. I think they just announced that Shanaka is not going to be the captain for the World Cup, which is bizarre. I mean, why on earth would you do that?
No, but that would be a big blow for me. I mean, I understand he's not going to
play, but...
Yeah. Oh, really?
I mean, after one match like that, yeah.
No, but if he's not the captain, I don't think he commands a place in the 11 anymore. For
me. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And I think that's okay. No, so I just saw yesterday. Sorry, this was late last night. He's been asked to continue as captain until the World Cup. They reversed their decision.
No, but that's what I expect, really.
Yeah. After an emergency meeting, it says. Even for Sri Lanka cricket, it's a bit much.
Exactly. So, okay, that settles that. But I think they just had a really bad day. They had no way out.
Yeah.
Because, look, between them, I think Bumrah started it off. He got Kusal Parera out, the dangerous Kusal Parera. But then, I think they both have been actually very incisive. And more importantly, I think Pandya has been backing them up very well. We saw this in the Pakistan game as well.
Yes.
So, it gives you a lot of hope as, you know, a home cricket fan from India, if the Indian fast bowling can actually start that way. Even on Indian pitches, even on Asian pitches.
Yeah, I think India's got one of the best bowling attacks in this World Cup. You've got with Siraj, Bumrah, Pandya, Kuldeep and Jadeja. Bizarrely enough, we are saying this to back them up. I think you have to say that, you know, that has to be one of the best ODI bowling attacks in the world today.
So from there, I think India are also trying to fine-tune a couple of small things, right? So in a three ODI series against Australia, they have picked one or two bolters, if that's the term we can use. At least one of them cannot run too fast, I think, Ravichandran Ashwin. But okay, by the by. They have picked some people you would not expect to be in the squad, even at the last minute. So somebody like Washington Sundar and Ravichandran Ashwin, given that there is some injury to Akshar Patel. So the question is, do you think this is like a last gasp change of mind? Maybe Rohit or the team management at the end, they decided they will always benefit if they have one very good off-break bowler as well in the squad. And then Akshar may miss out even if he's fit or if he gets fit a bit later. Or is it just something they're considering, their squad is more or less set in their minds?
As if it was left to me, unless Mr. Modi insisted on having Akshar play in Ahmedabad, I wouldn't have Akshar in the World Cup squad. Honestly, it's got nothing to do with Akshar's quality. I think he's, you know, a really good bat when he's really needed. He's a bowler who can do the job. Unfortunately, if you look at the way he's playing currently, and I've heard excuses about him not getting chances, whatever, you know, it's a national side. I mean, you've got 1.4 billion people. It's the number one sport in the country, right? So, you know, you get a chance, you grab that chance, right? So Akshar has come in, he's not been bowling well, right? The matches where he bowled, I thought he was absolutely underwhelming. Except that one match where, you know, he India lost and he batted well. Other than that, I just don't see why you would have Akshar Patel in the team when you have Ravindra Jadeja already in the team. Okay, they may not be the same bowlers, but they are very similar bowlers, no matter what anybody says. You know, I wrote a book on spin bowling. I know a little bit about spin bowling, and I can tell you they're not that different from the way they bowl. So, from the beginning, we should have had an off-spinner in the team instead of Akshar. The excuse they gave for bringing in Washington Sundar was that Washington Sundar was already training with the Asian Games team.
Right.
And he was in match fitness, and therefore he was brought in. If I remember correctly, Ashwin was also playing in some domestic tournament at the same time,
right?
Where in Tamil Nadu. So he could also have been brought in, but now they're there. I don't know. We're going to have, as we are recording this, I think in a couple of hours, we'll find out whether who's playing in the ODI, whether it's Ashwin or whether it's Washington Sundar.
Right.
Left to me, I would send Washington Sundar to Hangzhou to play the Asian Games. I would put Ashwin in the team for sure. Because he gives, as a fifth bowler, as a sixth bowler, if you like, the kind of variety that, you know, is just precious, right? Because what do you have? You have Kuldeep, you have Jadeja, and then you bring in Ashwin in subcontinent pitches. Ashwin has improved his batting recently, so he's no mug with the bat.
Right.
Send him late down the order. I don't think he's going to bat any worse than Ashadul Thakur, or he's going to bat, you know, any worse than an Akshar, to be very fair.
So for me, well, if you want to include Ashwin, he should not be the sixth bowler. He should be one in the top five for me, simply because he's worth it. He can give you eight overs.
He's only, Ajit, don't get me wrong. He's only the sixth bowler because Hardik Pandya is there.
Okay. Fine.
Yeah. So we actually have six proper bowlers. Yeah.
I mean, I expect Hardik will play most of the games if he's fit, simply because he'll give you that balance.
I think all of these guys will play.
Yeah.
All of these guys will play.
I mean, what I'm trying to say is Shardul might be sort of a backup to Hardik, but Hardik will start and India will go with two fast bowlers, Shami, Bumrah, Siraj. Two of these.
I don't think Shami makes the team.
Shami will not make the team at the start.
I don't think Shami makes the team at the start. He might come in for, you know, one or two games.
Right.
I would say Hardik will play if he's fit. He will play every game. I would say Shardul would actually. It would either be Shardul or Ashwin or Akshar, depending on who's there, who takes that spot.
Okay. No, but does the left-handedness batting and the batting potential that Washington Sundar, at this stage, I don't know if he's any better than Ashwin, but at least he has some very relevant test innings. So Do you think he may be more exciting that way? That's why he could have been picked, and also maybe his utility in the field.
I think we are overestimating the utility in the field and underestimating Ashwin just because he's not as fast as Washington Sundar. As far as the left-hand batting is concerned, you've now got potentially Ishan Kishan in the team if he's playing instead of Rahul for whatever reason. And you've got Jadeja, who's a left-hand back. I don't know if that is the reason for which one would play Washington Sundar.
Right. So then that's that one small point which is now pretty much up and out there. Surya Kumar Yadav versus somebody else. He didn't cover himself in glory in Asia Cup either.
Well, he got one chance. Mm-hmm. He's not been playing particularly well in ODI.
Right.
He's not made a secret of that fact. He's been open about his conversations with Rahul Dravid and with Rohit in terms of what he needs to do. And we all know what Surya Kumar Yadav's problem is, right? I mean, he is so invested in the shortest format that he doesn't place the value on his wicket that you need in an ODI. You need to have the patience to stay around for some time, which Ishan Kishan has learned, which is why he's doing well.
Correct.
Right? And if Sky cannot get that into the way he plays cricket, he will never play anything but T20.
Right.
And I hope that that's not going to be the case because they're showing a lot of faith in him. Dravid's just confirmed. I saw a Dravid interview yesterday, where he's saying Sky is very much a part of the World Cup team. Think about Sky actually managing to get over this and doing well and coming in as a finisher. That's what you want. He'll be the most incredible, like Klaassen or something. He'll be one of the most incredible finishers in ODI cricket if he manages to last that long.
Yeah, I mean, or you keep him in the squad and send him in only after the 42nd over or 38th over, thinking that you go play a T20. You forget the rest of it.
That is the plan. That is the plan. But the problem with Sky right now is even if you send him in the 42nd over, he'll probably be out by the 44th.
Ah, okay.
It's the way he's playing. It's the way he's looking at the game. We're putting it. It's a risk reward, right? I mean, I used to be a banker for many years, right? Mm-hmm. Banking is all about risk reward, right? Now, in this case, the way Sky plays, it's a pure risk reward play. You risk your wicket every ball in the shortest format to get the maximum out of it, right? And that is the mindset he needs to get out of in ODI.
That's a good one. Yeah, I think you've hit it on the head there. Let's see if he's able to convert it. It's mostly, as you say, it's a mind game. In his case, it's not a skills thing. So I think he has the right people around him who can help him get to that point where he's useful enough that his inclusion at the end, it's for me, it's like that. I think Rohit backs Surya. And at the end of the day, as a captain, you want to do that where from the outset, from statistics, from every other perspective, it may look in a different way. But if you have a gut feeling about a player, same for Dravid, I guess. So that's why I think Rohit said he gave Ashwin a call. He may have gotten this gut feeling at the end moment where he says, I want this guy. When we look back at the tournament, depending on how the results go, maybe we may look back and say this might be the genius move by Rohit to include Ashwin and Surya.
And totally, Ajit, because if you think about it, when was Akshar picked in the 15? Akshar in the World Cup team. Mm. Akshar was picked before the Asia Cup started.
Right.
So if we have observed how Akshar is bowling, Rohit's obviously observed how Akshar is bowling. Mm. Right. So that, with the fact that Akshar got injured, might be just the opportunity that Rohit needed to bring Ashwin into the fold, having realized that it was probably a mistake not to have him right there. Or maybe it wasn't a mistake. If Akshar had really been bowling very well, it may not have been a mistake, but he isn't bowling well. So going up to the World Cup, you need that bowler to be really performing at their absolute best.
That makes sense. Now, moving on to the other series, which I think was very interesting from World Cup prep perspective. So it is the Australia-South Africa series. So what brings out the best among these two teams when they play each other, especially in South Africa? I mean, if you look at the fourth ODI, something incredible happened. I mean, from 194 in the 35th over, South Africa went on to make 416. I mean, last 15 overs, they have actually bludgeoned 230 odd runs. Or 225 odd runs. I don't know how that came about, but we saw it happen. Henry Klaassen actually showed what he can do between him and David Miller. How much of a team killer each of them can be, or combined, they can simply probably decimate a team in an entire tournament. So Adam Zampa, unfortunately, we never thought anybody would ever concede 113, but well, he went and equaled that.
I think it's the second time somebody is conceding.
Mick Lewis had done that.
Runs. Okay.
I mean, yeah. Mick Lewis in that whatever immortal ODI where 800 runs were made, I think they actually
434 or
something like that, right? So 860 odd runs when they were made.
Zampa will be scarred for life.
Huh? Unfortunately. So I mean he's going to go to the World Cup. He's a strong lad. He's been in the international circuit for a decade close. But nonetheless, you'd feel that pain. But I mean, the way South Africa came back, does it bode really well for them? Do you think that they've actually found some steel? It could have been easily, you know, they had lost the T20 series. They were two down in the ODI series. Another game lost, the series would have been lost and it would have been all downhill. But they dug deep and they came out of it. Do you think we are seeing a new side of South Africa?
I absolutely hope so. You know, I had this very interesting, in the leadership work that I do now, one of the my business partners who I work quite a lot with is Paddy Upton. And Paddy and I were chatting a few months ago when we were in Singapore doing a program together. We were chatting one night over drinks and I precisely asked him this, that what is it about South Africa? Why does South Africa choke, right? And he had a very interesting theory. So he said, contrast the two teams, precisely these two teams, right? Australia and South Africa. Australia may not always be in a position where they have a winning squad, a really top squad, but they will delude themselves into believing they're the best team in the world and they can win. And they will believe their own bullshit and go out and execute it. Okay? He said, and if you look at South Africa, they may be the best squad in the world, but they're so set in their mind that they're not good enough to win and they're going to fail that they're going to fail.
Mm.
He said, that's been the mindset of these two teams for a very long time. So he said, the day South Africa is able to turn that around, they'll go and do it. And as a South African, I'm sure he hopes that this is going to be the time, right?
Right, right. I mean, I can imagine, right? So from such a strong sporting culture, they also produce some very strong on-field leaders, right? So do you think Themba Bavuma may have been the trick that may have turned the South African team's fortunes around if it were to actually happen?
It was a brave move. It was a brave move because Themba Bavuma wasn't the obvious captain to run that team, right? And he went through a very bad patch, if you remember. I mean, when we were both commentating for Guerrilla Cricket a few months ago, right?
Yeah, yeah. He couldn't buy a run.
He was no. I mean, it was sad to see him on the field, right? But you may well be right. I mean, he had what it took as a captain to bring the best out of people. And that's what you need as a captain, right? I mean, why is Mike Brayley remembered for being a captain and not a player?
There was a player called Ian Botham in that 11. But all right. I mean, yeah. I'm just saying, from that perspective, he may be, you know, that miracle thing that might hold the South African team together, maybe take them to semifinals. But then they're always good enough to come there or get somewhere close. Yeah. And then they choke. And then some genius takes them down. Usually it's a Lara or somebody like that. But this team may have the belief to outlast or outpunch even such a genius performing on his day. So that's going to be interesting for me to see. I think on that day, the final of that World Cup, if a South African or a New Zealander lifts this trophy, a lot of the cricketing world will be happy or relieved, I think. Above and beyond their own teams. But I don't know if you look at it that way.
I'm not a huge fan of New Zealand cricket, so I'm probably the wrong person to ask. I'm probably the only Indian cricket fan who's not a fan of New Zealand. But that aside, I think from a team perspective, I don't think New Zealand's good enough to get to the semi-final. And I know this has been said before in several World Cups.
Mm.
I'm sitting here and telling you this, and unfortunately for you, unlike David Frith, I don't have a newspaper which I can eat, and I'm not writing on it. But I have lots of paper here. I'm happy to eat one piece of paper if New Zealand gets to the semifinals of the World Cup.
All right, get your ketchup ready. Who knows? All right, yeah. But coming back to South Africa, that's all right. I just meant that from a
I think I'll be very happy if South Africa gets to the World Cup.
There you go. I mean, all I'm saying is, it'll be sort of a relief for that nation, but also for a lot of us. I'd rather see South Africa win again instead of an Australia. Let me put it like that.
Australia is not the most well-loved cricket team in the world. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
And their mindset is that they're actually happy with it. That's fantastic. They're like, we don't care.
Yep.
Come the World Cup, exactly. We're going to go there and win and break your team's heart. Something like this. So that's also a fantastic mindset. And it takes a certain kind of thought process to break across that. That's what South Africa were able to do to take that series. But then Quinton de Kock has decided he'll hang up his ODI boots as well. And he's going to be purely a T20I player, or T20I mercenary. Yeah. Does that surprise you, first of all? He's still very young, sporting terms.
Yeah, but not really. You know, that's the way from a commercial standpoint that a lot of players have gone in the recent past. I expect more of that to happen. You know, Ajit, if you think about it, right? ODIs, honestly, are important in an ODI World Cup year. I mean, let's be brutal about this, right? How much time do you spend talking about ODIs in the other 3 years? Either we speak about Test cricket among the major teams, I'm not talking about, you know, the smaller teams, or we talk about T20 all the time. Right, the money comes from T20. It subsidizes Test cricket in a way. ODIs, despite our love for them, for the format, fall somewhere in the crack. So why should we be surprised that Quinton de Kock wants to concentrate on for the rest of his career in a place where he'll make most of his money, and while he still plays Test cricket?
So now for me, look, that's a bit of a sore point simply because I thought, I'm being a purist, this guy could win test matches. And there's nothing bigger in the game than a person being able to win test matches that doesn't want to play tests anymore. Simply because there's another format that pays him better. So this is a longer discussion, but now going back to the point about Bavuma,
he's not the only one, right?
No, not at all. See, there are a few people who decided to hang up their test boots after, I don't know, 34, when they were 34, 35, that I can see as something very relevant. He stopped playing test cricket when he was 27 or 28. That for me, he was injury prone. I understand he was a keeper. Probably it requires a certain higher level of fitness to remain relevant and do your job really well in tests, right? But for me, just that he chose to stop playing when he was 28 rather than 34, that meant 30 good more tests for South Africa from his perspective. That's all. I mean, I thought had the same quality as an Adam Gilchrist who could change test matches in the blink of an eye or half an hour or an hour. That is the one thing that I feel that's unfortunate. That's all. But I respect his choice as a player. But do you think Bavuma, the skipper, may bring him back into the fold?
I think you'll see de Kock back in the test team. I mean, now that if he's, you know, I'm just saying that from the perspective that it's very difficult today, you know, to be a Virat Kohli at the level that he is, or a similar player where you're still playing all three formats, right? So maybe the fact that he's now hanging up his ODI boots is reason, and he's still 30, as you said. So, is reason for him to go back and play test cricket for a few more years? Maybe. You can hope. One can hope, right?
No, absolutely. So, I'm only hoping, no, the powers that be are actually listening to what you just said and he gets to play test matches again. He changes his own mind. All right. From that point, we move again a little bit further. So, England. So, New Zealand, England played a long limited overs series to sort of set their pieces in place. At least for England, they made at least one, I would like to think, as something interesting in terms of a change. At the last minute, Roy, who sort of did a little bit of what he could this year, he scored some hundreds, crucial hundreds away. But he was left out in favor of Harry Brook. Is that a knee-jerk reaction? Is that something England have done with future in mind? Or is it only for this World Cup where they... Because you can feel that potentially Roy's career is over after this.
I would have taken Jason Roy in the team. I think we also had this discussion in the Guerrilla Cricket group, where you know, I was surprised that Roy would be dropped for Harry Brook. I understand, you know, how good Harry Brook is. I understand he's the future for England, perhaps in all formats. But I also note that the guy's got an average in the 20s, as far as, you know, ODI is concerned. You are using him to replace somebody who's in the mid 40s, and probably his experience in India in the ODI format would have been invaluable for England. I don't know how far England is going to go in this competition. I suspect they're not going to go as far as they did in 2019, although they're an extremely good team.
Look, they are a good team. Would you see them as potential semifinalists, or you say, no, that's too much? Too much expectation?
No. I mean, of course they would be a potential. I mean, come on. Of course they're potential semifinalists. I mean, for me, Australia, South Africa, India, England are probably the most likely semifinalists. And then you've got a few more who could be there. You could have Bangladesh, as I said. You could have New Zealand. I'd have to eat a piece of paper, but
that's okay.
It could well be.
Yeah,
won't be the worst thing in the world. And you know, pretty much a semifinal. The fourth semifinal slot is quite difficult to predict. But I would definitely say that England are, you know, semifinal material.
Fair enough. You left out one team which I expect to almost always feature in these discussions, Pakistan. But again, as I said, you acknowledge that it's tough to pick.
The reason why I left out Pakistan is very, I actually would have had Pakistan in there. I think with the fact that they don't have Naseem for the World Cup, and they in all likelihood are not going to have Shahin Afridi for the first half of the World Cup.
Wow.
Which really makes their bowling weak. And Rauf is not bowling at the best that I've seen him bowling.
About Shaheen Shah?
Yes.
This one, did you read this somewhere, or has it come to your notice?
Yes, they've announced that he's not going to be playing for the first three matches.
Oh dear.
They announced yesterday that he's not going to be playing for the first
three matches. I missed this, but then it's a huge blow. I understand.
Yeah.
That sort of puts a major dent in their, in their chances. Only because I know you can start slow, there's enough matches, but you don't want to lose too many matches too easily.
Yeah.
Now, coming back to England, I think David Malan may have sort of done enough. He made himself undroppable. He scored too many runs in that series. You basically can't look at a team without him at this immediate future. That's what he ensured. Yeah. Maybe that's the thing that hurt Roy, but again, the other thing, their reliance or their retention of Root, even though he couldn't get a game against Ireland yesterday, Root, I think, is sort of a shoe-in in that squad simply because of what he can do as a banker. Do you see he deserves his place in the England squad in the World Cup?
I think he's done enough to deserve a place in the ODI format. You know, the skills that he has in the longest format are precious in the role that they need him to play in ODIs. And he has the ability to score quickly when it's needed. He's shown us that enough time. He's shown his strokes enough time. I mean, he doesn't go into a shell when he doesn't need to, right? And the stability and the experience of Root, I think, will be quite crucial for it.
I mean, they have picked both Brook and Root simply because they're good test match players, and that they are going to be able to transform that into what is required in an ODI. I'm just thinking, if there is a little bit of a failure from the top order, it might put too much pressure on the likes of Stokes and Butler, who may end up getting injured as the tournament goes on if the likes of Brook and Root cannot deliver. But
well,
it's again,
Ajit, I think the thing is that why that just might work for England is because of the whole baseball approach that they have absolutely embraced. So the baseball approach in test cricket means that, and I'm not sure people realize how drastic it has been. I mean, on average for the past 150 years, and I mean, I digress a little bit, but there is a point to this that over the last 140 odd years of Test cricket, the average Test score for a team has been about the average has been about 3. Consistently, England scores above 4, 4.5 actually. Okay, so you know, the fact that they've been playing like this for the at least the past 2 years means that even players like Brook or players like Root are in that mold already. So going into the ODI, going faster, scoring faster is not a challenge for these guys anymore. In a mindset, you know, from a mindset standpoint, 2 years ago it might have been for Joe Root. Today it's not. So I think people forget that transition is much easier for them to make today from a strike rate standpoint.
All right. So from them to the other team, which you've acknowledged is not one of your favorites, Tim Southee has injured his thumb. He looks doubtful. And, well,
probably doubtful for a couple of matches, right? I mean, should be fine after that.
Now, because I still think, you know, he had his skills might be on the wane in the shortest format or shorter formats, but I think he still has enough experience and leadership to show as far as New Zealand are concerned. And that's why I think Kane is also very important. So,
yes,
let's see how that goes. And so, before we forget, South Africa also got a blow yesterday that Norkia and Magala have been ruled out. So, because for me...
Are they ruled out for the entire World Cup? Or?
Yes. No, they're ruled out for the entire World Cup. So, they have already replacements that have been named in their stead. So, Andele Pehlukwayo and Lizard Williams will go in the 15-man squad in the place of Heinrich Norkia and Sisanda Magala. So, Nortia has a suspected stress fracture of the back, while Magala is nursing a left knee injury, apparently. So, that's a bit of a pity. Because for me, again, I would have loved seeing Norkia and Rabada bowl together. And somebody like Marco Janssen or Gerald Coetzee backing them up in that South African 11. Yeah. But do you think...
Janssen's been fantastic, right?
Yeah. I mean, he's the one that won that fifth ODI, right? By himself. All by himself against Australia. But for me, do you think this might really affect South Africa's chances going into the World Cup?
Tough to say. I mean, I would... Rick Nokia, I'd want him in my team anytime, right? It's tough to say. Their replacement just might do the trick. For me, it's more whether they choke as a batting unit or not.
Right.
Is what's going to make the difference for them.
Okay. Let's see. You're probably right. Their bowling has always been up to mark, up to scratch. But yeah. In terms of some other cricket news, on-field cricket news. So, we have been discussing women's cricket over the last couple of episodes in terms of a series. So, Sri Lanka were able to actually do something special in the T20Is, but unfortunately in the ODIs, the Sri Lankan women's team were beaten 3-0 by England. They had already lost the series 2-0, but in the last game, it was a shortened game because of rain, but Nat Brunt came out and hit 120 of just 74 balls, really put the game to bed even before the second innings, you could think, in just 31 overs, right? So England made 273.
Yeah.
And that's nearly 9 and over to start off. And it very easily becomes 10. And, you know, in these sort of ODIs, you know they are in trouble. And Sri Lanka, I think it was also the last game of a long tour. And they had lost the series. The dead rubber syndrome kicked in and they lost. So they lost the series 3-0. But they'll still take something very, very important away. They won a series in England. And it'll give them a lot of confidence going forward in the future. Similarly, the other ODI series where Pakistan were playing South Africa at home, there it was going to be a very tough thing for Pakistan because they had lost the ODI series 2-0. But in the dead rubber, they were able to take the series. So Pakistan will think of it as a more or less a successful set of games simply because they won the T20 series 3-0, but the ODI series, it was 2-1 for South Africa. South Africa are on sort of a rebuild. They have a little to look forward to. So they won't consider this to be too bad a result as far as I'm concerned. But at least with many of their key players missing, they accounted well enough for themselves, and they will want to do well whenever they tour Asia again in the future. These were all some of the on-field news. But if we go off-field, which is non-World Cup related at least. So we heard that Stuart McGill is in the news for all the wrong reasons on India.
He has been over for various wrong reasons over the past couple of years.
Hmm.
So, yeah, this time it's drug-related. Hmm. The last time it was he was kidnapped.
Yeah, I mean, they're related, I think. They're both stories. That kidnapping whole thing apparently was some sort of a setup because he owed some drug dealers a lot of money. So it was not them extorting money from him, but sort of asking back the money they were owed, so on. So
it's just saddening, you know, the kind of bowler that he was. I mean, if Warne had not been there, McGill would have been, you know, one of the greatest leg spinners Australia ever had. He was so talented, so good. And you look at him now, you look at the picture and you're like, wow, I mean, what's the man come to?
That's the point. I mean, the fall, you know, the fall of somebody like him, it's a very sad thing because there are a few cricketers we know have fallen so far from where they were. I think there was an English player, Lewis, if I'm not wrong, he was caught drug dealing and was sentenced to prison. It's a very sad thing, but looks like this may have been going on for a while and finally he may have been caught because they have been, they're strict on him. They've given him a strict conditional bail because it's a drug charge and he's had to surrender his passport so that it doesn't leave the country. So it seems very serious. We wish him all the best and we really hope he comes out on the other side a much improved person in terms of where he's got to and maybe gets a couple of, you know, coaching gigs or some talking gigs and he stays out of trouble that way.
Completely. I mean, you can only wish him well that he comes out of this.
The other thing, Nasir Hussain, a former Bangladesh, in fact, all format player, and he's only 31 now. That means when he did this, he was only potentially 28 or 29 because in 2021's Abu Dhabi T10 tournament, he's been charged for not declaring gifts that was more than $750 of value. But he's one among many players who've been charged. So you were telling me off air, he plays for a franchise called Pune Devils. All 8 people that were charged were from this franchise.
Including the two co-owners.
Exactly.
So I suspect the gifts were more than 750, but probably substantially more than 750.
Yeah, but that's what it becomes in the end. Is it just a gift or is it something else is the question. So the ACC has learned...
I mean, it's the Middle East, right? What do you think with the whole, you know, the betting and the match fixing? It's always been the home of that. Right.
Well,
so you have a tournament in there. It's not very unusual to find this in that tournament.
We know it happened right through the 80s and 90s, we are told. And look, will they ever clean up their act there? Or is it just going to be always like that? That when some cricket happens in the Middle East, especially if it's not the highest tier, people look at it with narrow slanted eyes and talk murmur that, you know, we know what's going on.
It's unfortunate, right? Because if you know, the potentially when the T10 format first came about, I was one of the very few people who were actually in favor of the format. Just because I saw the value in having a match which, you know, potentially finished in 3 hours, right? Or less. 90 minutes, sorry. Which finished in 90 minutes, which for me could be one way of popularizing cricket as much as football from a viewer standpoint, right? In countries where it was not necessarily, they were not necessarily tuned to watching a match for 3.5 hours, which the T20 is like.
Right.
But the fact that it started in Abu Dhabi and has stayed there and has not picked up anywhere else, I guess is a surefire way of telling that most people have not found that format to be to their liking. And the fact that it remains there, which means it's become very localized, in which case, you know, this kind of thing is much easier to do there, right? With the local bookies, etc. I'm just hoping that this is an exception and the rest of the tournament doesn't suffer from it. Thankfully, the other teams have not come under the same scrutiny and the same charges. So, you know, hopefully they clean up their act.
Absolutely. So also from cricket's perspective, it's never nice to hear about these things going on. We know it's there. There's a murky underbelly. But we don't want to really encourage those things. And you want to think...
No, because it makes fans suspect. Yeah, exactly. It makes fans suspect legitimate games when, you know, this... It really gets me mad, right? I mean, Asia Cup final. 50 all-out Sri Lanka. I mean, I had people who should have known better... you know, friends, old friends, basically asking, do you think it was fixed? And I was like, seriously? I mean, a team can have a bad day, right? You remember Adelaide, India in Adelaide? So you think that match was fixed? And so it's just, the problem is that you can't even blame fans because, you know, this whole, from the Hans Cornier to the whole episode, now with all of this going on, the Pakistani players who got, you know, banned in England, so it's just been going on and on and on, right? And you are absolutely right that muddies waters in legitimate forms of cricket where clean matches are being played.
No, you're right. It makes a fan very suspicious. I mean, especially when IPL is going on, there is a lot more things flying around. If you are a fan who's sitting on the side and just looking at it, there are many people who are so suspicious of how close the matches are always are. But it could just be the quality of players and the, I know, the personnel involved. So, but that's what you're right when you say, you know, it throws up unnecessary suspicions on cleaner formats and cleaner games. Yeah. So that's always a bad thing. And at the end, it's all about the fans, we may think, but it's also about the purity of what we are trying to deliver and keeping it clean. And at the end, sport should stand for just war without guns and many people being able to excise or exorcise certain things that they want to rather than anything else. But let's see how that comes about. So we've reached the end of all the topics we had in mind for this episode on India. Thank you very much for a very, very informative chat. And as I recommended to our listeners earlier on, I will include a link to your Amazon page with all your books. So we do hope more of our listeners are able to pick and read your books. It's been very nice talking to you. Would you like to give out any other outlets that you're available on if any of our listeners want to reach out to you or where they can follow you?
Sure. I'm on Twitter and my handle is @ Crick _ writer. That's CRIC_WRITER. I'd love to connect with people on Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn. Very happy to, you know, meet up with people there. I do a lot of work where I link sports and leadership. So anybody who has interest in that, I actually write a whole series there on sports and leadership. So anyone who wants to do that. My company is called Two Roads, so I have a page on which that writing is there on LinkedIn. I'm happy to communicate with anyone who wants there. I'm on Instagram with the same handle, Crick_writer. So happy to meet up there as well. And thank you so much, Ajit, for inviting me and really, you know, enjoyed the conversation. Fantastic topic, you know, great questions, and as always, even whether we are on commentating on Gorilla Cricket or here, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure having a conversation with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The pleasure was also all mine. And I hope to have you sometime again, time and other things permitting.
Look forward to it.
And we wish all our listeners a good day wherever they may be listening from. Thank you and bye-bye.
This is the Armchair Cricket Podcast.